to the rapists.
Yeah, but
it's okay. I mean them bare necessities, oh, Mother Nature's recipes. The simple bare necessities of life.
First camp out, like X Day. And
on your third year, you get shit ticks.
Ick. Those are terrible. And that voice is the voice of the Reverend Onan Canobite, who publishes the subgenius newspaper, the Dobstown Mirror.
Yeah, this is unedited.
I am still trying to contact him, but since he doesn't believe in social media, it is difficult. But I want him to publicize this show in his journal. The other one, The Void of Slack, is well covered and contains art and comics by me, Dr. Howland Owl. Perhaps we will expand the subgenius publication list. We already published several books, including Neighbor World by Lonesome Cowboy Dave.
I've got John Diss.
As long
because,
as
because John is dissed
always.
As long as those militant Christianity newsletters.
Yes, Bill Cosby's anti-drug album. He says, "Pull up your pants and don't take drugs." And we'll see how the U.S. responded to that advice. Of course, this is not the original anti-drug album by Bill Cosby, but the version by DJ Female Convict Scorpion that you are now hearing. In our greater educational mission. There is one there. What a nuisance. we see one? Well, let me try those. In fact, all the echo that was plaguing this is now gone, but we have an increase in volume. Say something, Floyd.
Hello.
This is Floyd Tangeman, one of the cartoonists I mentioned, and we also have Apple Berry here.
Hey.
I hope these cartoonists are audible. It's been my pleasure to work with them in recent days. And they tend to draw during the night. The time when I am up and active. Though, surprisingly, I got a call from you during the day, so when do you sleep? You were calling me in the morning. I wondered about that.
Oh, well, all sorts of different plans. But when they're fuller, that's with sleeping, that's interesting.
Well, not everyone needs the same amount of sleep.
Right, he said you could get 30 minutes every 6 hours. That's all you need.
Cat naps, eh?
Yeah, but I like to sleep for a long amount of time. I usually sleep until late if I can.
Yes.
I like to stay up if I can, like through a sunrise drawing. That's a successful accomplishment.
The body demands sleep. Well, keep trying, but I'm not sure we've got you turned up here.
Can you try into this microphone?
I can hear you in the room, but not on this beleaguered, blankety-blank microphone.
That's not good.
No, it ain't. And it's not the only thing that's not good around here. Well, it's a poor workman who blames his tools, as somebody said. Let me see now. Try that one, yes. Might work. Sorry about this. Just speak a few words into it.
Words. Bird is the word.
No, dang it.
This one doesn't work.
This one will work, I believe. Did you just turn it down? It seems like
what about
you? But this one, I think, has a little bit of volume. Give it a try.
These headsets are loud. Oh, yeah, I can hear myself, though. Turn the music down a little bit.
We don't need no stinking music. Anyway, now I think we are set up enough so that we can talk about a subject which concerns us all, which is to say, comics.
Yes, very concerning topic.
What are you working on these days?
Multiple projects. Paradise.
Good.
Paradox.
Uh-huh.
It's like a big, like, archetypal paradise theme going on there.
That's why I thought you'd like that Dance of Death comic that I did.
Yes, I loved it. That was so great.
Oh, thank you.
It reminds me of the strip I'm working on right now. I have, like,
good.
Souls in the tree, Adam and Eve in it. It's like pretty simple stuff, but yours is way better.
Oh, don't say that. These are useful tools in the toolbox. It's a place to start from, at any rate. There's always more to be said on mythopoetic subjects.
Yes, always.
William Blake.
Yes, a master of that.
Mythopoeia, or the plural of mythopoetics.
Yes, that's true.
Yeah.
From the Greek word.
This is a killer track.
From The Ventures, I believe.
The Ventures?
Yes.
Very nice.
From their album, A Go-Go.
Paradise Paradox is going to be published in a magazine called Jaywalk, which I edit. And
when does that come out?
Soon this year, God willing. We'll have to, probably around March, I would say.
Well,
we've got
time
cover for it.
We'll fly by, as I was saying. I'm going to be taking a trip, but I'll certainly be back by then.
Yeah.
Unless all hell breaks loose and they close down the airports.
Where are you going?
I'm going first to New Orleans and then to New York State. And on the 20th, when Trump takes over, I'll be in my sister's house up in the snow. I will be in there watching monster movies and hoping that the storm passes us by. But I have to go down to Manhattan on the train, though they're trying to kill all the trains also. But I'm planning to go down and be in a show with Zero Boy at the Slipper Room in the Village in Manhattan. It's a nice burlesque house where I've had fun performing before. And he's an interesting cat because he's intently studied a number of things, including the history of gangsters. And he gives people tours of New York to where gangster activities happened, and he does it in the character of Johnny Z, who is himself a gangster and a great guide. It's been very well reviewed. I'd enjoy going on one of those.
Did he personally know this guy? Like, how did he get the impression new?
Oh, he made the character up, but he studied what they all did. And I know a little bit about it, since I worked on a show that involved Vincent Mad Dog Cole, Arthur Flagenheimer, a.k.a. What was his name? Very famous gangster, I can't remember at the moment. But Legs Diamond also. It'll come to me. My subconscious mind will give me the answer. And as we speak, Floyd is continuing to ink and draw.
It's true. I'm still working on this comic book, Miasma Myopia, but I was hoping to honestly have it finished and scanned by today, the entire book, so that my friend and assistant, Deji, he's going to get started on coloring it soon, the entire book.
Great. Coloring, that's wonderful.
Yeah, it's going to be in color.
I love black and white, but the public is fond of color.
Yeah, I love black and white too, and I've published these works originally in black and white, but I'm interested in, since I'm going to be working with the publisher, just taking advantage of doing it in color, because they have the resources to do it, you know, hardcover and color, so. And, you know, a dream of mine is to see my work animated, too, so color begins to lend itself to that, you know? I mean, God, it's hard to see any. There are still good animation studios nowadays, you know?
There have been great cartoons in black and white.
Definitely. I mean, I love Ralph Bakshi's work. I'm a big fan of Ralph Bakshi's work. And
how about the Fleischer brothers? Do you like them?
Of course, I love the Fleischer brothers. Yeah, of course. The Fleischer brothers are the greatest. I got a DVD of Hoppity Goes to Town, but I haven't watched it yet.
Interesting movie.
It was released on a Pearl Harbor day, right?
A disaster for the Fleischer brothers because they lost their European markets on that day when the world welcomed the U.S. into World War II, and they really needed the income. Eventually, Paramount took over their studio.
So let me ask you this, Hal. Do you think we're in World War III, World War IV, or something later?
It's hard to tell.
Yeah.
But there's a Philip K. Dick story about these people who are at home comfortably, and then there's a time slip of some kind, and soldiers from a future war invade their house and say, look at this, a refrigerator of food, and they're going in, and they're ragged and wounded and horrible, and they, you know, they figure out that they're from the future, and they're saying, well, you're from this World War III or IV, what is it, when did it start? And they say, you idiot, it's already started in your time, you just didn't recognize it.
Right, exactly. Yeah.
So that could be the case.
Yeah, I mean, I was talking to a history student, or someone who, a history teacher actually, not a history student, and I asked him the same question, and he said, well, World War III was waged in the Pacific, so by now we're at least at World War IV.
Well, the Pacific War was an offshoot of the Second War. Apple.
I'm not too good with wars or anything, but I'm writing the notes down on my leg. We're on World War IV right now because the third one was in the Pacific.
Well,
what's going on there? What happened in the Pacific?
The Japanese invasion of Manchuria and Indonesia, and finally culminating in the Russians attacking Japan and the atomic bombs dropped on Japan.
What year was that?
1945.
That wasn't World War II?
That was World War II.
Right. Okay.
World War III, maybe someone considers the Korean / Vietnam War World
exactly.
War III.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Ah, well, it wasn't so much a world war because people were allowed to ignore it over here and be outraged when anybody brought it up. But the more countries involved, the more it becomes a world conflict.
Speaking of World War III, have either of you heard or seen any issues of World War III Illustrated?
I remember that. Wasn't it a Warren publication?
It's been published by many different publishers over the years. I think at this point it's the longest-running anthology series in Underground Comics.
That's pretty cool.
And I'm going to be in the next issue.
Wonderful.
It's Seth Kabachman is one of the editors. I met him when I was in New York City. He's truly an incredible artist. If you aren't familiar with his work, I really recommend you look into it.
Where would you be able to pick up a copy of World War III? At the comic store on Valencia Street in San Francisco?
Maybe at the comic store, and most, even more likely, your local radical bookstore, like Bound Together Bookstore, the anarchist bookstore on State Street. They have copies. I've seen it there. I can remember seeing it there. But Seth Tabachman's individual work, too, such as You Don't Have to Fuck People Over to Survive, is an incredible graphic masterpiece. He has another graphic novel called War in the Neighborhood, but I haven't read that one.
Sounds good.
Very, very highly recommended to all your viewers. Seth Tabachman. Maybe one of the greatest living underground cartoonists, I would definitely say.
Good.
Other news related to comics. I'm being tasked right now by the Comics Journal.
Excellent.
To write a list, a comprehensive list of the 100 best comics of all time.
Oh, good. Well, that's good.
And then it's going to be weighed with a bunch of other critics' lists.
Uh-huh.
We're going to put them all together and create a true list of the 100 best comics of all time.
And is it comprehensive enough to mention Belgian cartoonists like Hergé and so forth?
As long as their work has been published in English, it qualifies.
In the Casterman editions, they have been. And I really like those. I'm not put off by anything about them. I'm attracted to the Line Claire or Lean Claire style that Hergé originated.
Hergé is a great artist.
Hergé. How about the Blake and Mortimer series? Did you like those? Two old guys, you know, that time travel, all sorts of things that they do.
I can't say I've read that. I'll have to make sure to get that. I still have time.
They're from that same generation of Euro cartoonists, but they were succeeded by the El Vibora age.
I'll tell you what my number one comic of all time is.
Yeah?
Fantastic for your viewers. And then I'll tell you what my number two pick is, too.
All right, please do.
My number one pick for number one comic of all time is 7 Miles a Second by David Vaishnorovitz and James Romberger, colored by Marguerite Van Cook.
Is that in print today?
You would be able to get a copy today for under $30.
Not bad.
My pick for number two favorite comic book of all time is Life or Theater by Charlotte Salomon.
Uh-huh.
And I don't know if your viewers are familiar with either of those works, if you are, but, you know, 7 Miles a Second is not over 100 pages. You read it, right, Apple?
Over 100 pages?
It's not over 100 pages. Seven miles a second.
It is pretty short.
Yeah.
I could see it being 100 pages.
Yeah, about 100 pages.
Like, no more than that.
Yeah, exactly.
It's still graphic novel size.
Yeah.
Colors are beautiful.
Yeah.
Really, really great graphic novel.
Charles Burns just came out with some new books, and I assume you're a fan of his.
Yeah.
One is simply imaginary covers of imaginary comics, it's but it's so beautifully done.
With the K, two M's, and an X, yeah.
Yes. And sometimes logos in unknown imaginary language also on the cover of those.
Lovely, does that. Well, me and Charles Burns, we're actually, I went to New York and because we're actually in a comics magazine together right now.
Great.
That we were just published in together called Smoke Signal. It was the 43rd issue of Smoke Signal, and a Belgian cartoonist, actually, Olivier Schrauen, did the cover. And then Charles Burns did the inside front cover. Art Spiegelman and Bill Griffith were in it also.
Oh, that's good.
They did an edition of 6,000, and each of us were paid $200 for one page.
I know Bill quite well. I have to give him credit for putting out a fully drawn daily cartoon.
Yeah, and there's like six.
Some of those are really fun.
Published in Smoke Signal, and they look beautiful in the newspaper.
Well, it's just hard to have the energy to draw a fully rendered gag cartoon strip that is syndicated, you know. And he lives in Massachusetts, which is where the old cartoonists go.
What are the old cartoonists out there? Dennis Kitchen?
I think so. He was originally from the Middle West. It was sad when Jay Lynch died. It was so sad that Skip Williamson couldn't live with Jay Lynch gone and did away with himself. And that was a huge hole. Lynch did some covers for Mineshaft, though, that were quite good, typically good. Well, I could be wrong, and you'll have to be careful about what you say on the radio, but it is true, he's no longer with us, and he seemed not to be able to endure the passing of Jay Lynch, creator of Nard and Pat. Well, we're all here simply by the grace of the cosmos, and the floor could be jerked away at any moment and would fall into the infinite. Did I tell you my cover for the Firesign Theater's Ulysses versus the Cannibal Tacos from Outer Space is out?
Oh, I think you sent me an email with an image.
Oh, yeah. I've got some copies of the books now that they sent. It makes interesting reading those screenplays. I've worked on screenplays, and I used to write plays and musicals. I wrote a light opera, but you know, I've got to keep churning this stuff out.
We used to do a play together now. I've acted plays and I've written plays too before.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the greatest play, you know, as cartoonist, the greatest play is that, as Mike Rieger puts it, you know, you can be the actor, the playwright, the costumes, everything in a comic book, the director.
Well, that's true. You control the cinematography, the angle, the view, like in a screenplay where they no longer describe the shot, they just say, angle on so-and-so, you know, let the filmmaker, who they assume is able enough to figure out something, let them do it.
And it costs damn near no money to make it. Just a pencil and a paper.
That's right. And ink, ideally.
To write a play, you have to find actors. To make a movie, you have to buy the camera.
The movies tend to get expensive.
Yes.
I'm still hoping to revive the one I worked on.
What's the movie you're making?
Chameleons, you know, that thing that you saw exists in a better version, if we could only get it to happen, including some scenes that I directed that were cut out, which I'd love to have put back, but what can you do?
I don't know if the story is true or not, but did foreigners edit the movie and they didn't understand English?
That's true. Chinese tycoons. did it. And this was painful because the crew was coming to me and saying, hey, what's happening to the movie? And I couldn't tell them except that some people I never heard of were getting to mess with it. And that is the way it is in Hollywood, to speak generally. You can make the best thing in the world and then someone you never heard of in some other department will come and shit all over it, you know?
That is so fucked up.
Robbie Basho?
Yes, you recognize Robbie Basho. That's, I've always liked him.
Yeah, he's an interesting character. He's an interesting character. I know all about Robbie Basho. I mean, I guess I'm very interested in Robbie Basho, John Fahey too. I mean, Robbie Basho, the cause is surrounding his death is somewhat mysterious. Right?
His death was very unfortunate because he went to some spa and some phony hippie shaman thought it would be good for him to be shaken severely, you know. Like I've been told by these quacks that if you bounce up and down on a giant ball, you won't have a cold and so on. That's their expertise. But this marvelous man who essentially played Indian ragas, that sort of music on a 6 and 12 string guitar, was shaken so hard that it broke his neck and he died.
Oh my God.
Fortunately, we do have these records of his music.
I love his version of Claire de Lune.
Thank you for coming in and being another voice on this show, which is too often a monologue.
Yeah, thank you very much for coming by and giving me that book, the Bill Sienkiewicz cover.
I was happy to do it, and I hope after this is over to go back over to the place and do some drawing with you guys.
Oh yeah, we're drawing strips after this. We sure are.
I did think that one that Floyd and I worked on came out well. Where did you say that was going to be printed?
Motion?
Yes.
Well, we'll try to submit it to Mindshaft.
Oh, all right. We'll see about that. I have managed to digitize a bunch of stuff I'm sending to them, but I haven't written the cover letter yet. Meanwhile, the clock is ticking down to the time I'm going to have to take off on my trip. But I hope to be able to do it during this next week. Just to send it and see what Everett, the editor, thinks. He didn't like the St. Stupid thing that I drew. Yeah, but he said, we don't want to print anything about Jack T. Chick. And it's not at all about Jack T. Chick. I could give him one about Jack T. Chick. I think you saw both of the ones that I did.
You did it in a format of Jack T. Chick.
Yes, I thought that was a good format for a parody. Also, convenient, because I can't draw an entire comic book for this guy, you know, but I could draw one of those tracts and we could get it printed. It is a mini comic.
It's discrimination against a mini comic. Plus, I mean, Rieger's like has all sorts of different ways of formatting his mini comics so that they can be like printed in whatever different sort of periodical.
Yeah, he'll put 50 pages in a single mini comic.
Wow. Well, there's nothing like having a lot of energy.
Yes.
Necessary. It is hard work to keep at it. But sometimes you feel like you're just tapping into something that'll draw your comic.
Yeah, I feel like something does it for me. I black out when I draw my comics.
And then you look up and hours have passed.
And then it's there. I'm like, what the hell is this? It's crazy.
By in a second, you know, an hour will go by in a second, and an hour is almost meaningless unless it's 6 hours.
Yes, I know it's uncomfortable, but please keep your headphones on so you can monitor the audio that we're putting out.
Can you hear me?
Oh, yes, now I can hear you just fine.
I just had
I can get you some tissues. The bathroom is right there if you want them. This place is not as comfortable as the studio we used to have over on 20th Street, which was quite nice. It had an extra outside room with couches and so forth. But it turned out that prostitutes were entertaining their clients in there and other things. Mainly we got evicted so they could put in, a dance studio. And then we found this place, a former barbershop. It was a right little, tight little barbershop, as you can imagine. Not the boutique kind where they give you a hateful looking hairdo for $75 or more. A hairdo that makes somebody want to punch you right in the nose. But I think there's a great art to that.
Certainly. Yeah, but I was hoping to get my comic book finished today, and then my friend came over and looked at it, and I was like, what do you think? Do you think I can get this done in 1 hour? And he was like...
1 hour?
He was like, it's probably going to take you at least 30 hours. And so...
You know, people look at my drawings and say, how long did it take you to draw that? And that is something I never consider. You'd be defeated before you started when you try to ration the time. The thing takes its own time to be born. It takes the time it's going to use.
I mean, I do think about time. I do think about time in that way, of at least trying to put, at the very minimum, sometimes, or just like a good barometer reference point is like 10 hours for a page. If a page can get 10 hours, there's no way that it can be bad, in my opinion.
You can overdo it. You'll have to be careful not to do that, but...
As long as you fully develop all of the concepts that you're bringing to light.
Uh-huh. I agree.
And sometimes just the drawing itself is the concept developing itself because of the power of images, you know? I mean, I'm so obsessed with images. I mean, I think... It's safe to say we all are.
And the power of the combination of words and images, that is comic books.
And that makes it literature.
Yes.
Right. We are a part of the literary community, and they always want to forget us.
You know, Mavridis won the case against the California Franchise Tax Board, the state taxes, which were going to tax comics artists, like image makers. But as literateurs, which could be and was successfully argued, there's no tax. And they were resistant, but not so resistant when hideous caricatures of them became to appear, drawn by cartoonists. You can't win against the cartoonists, really.
That's what happens. That's what they get.
Yeah, just think about Boss Tweed.
And Thomas Nast.
Yeah, exactly. That's like my all-time idol when it comes to comics.
He was pretty good and funny.
Yeah, he was the greatest.
But there were a lot of those 19th century cartoonists that were really good and did their work in the steel engraving style, and the printing got better. The rotogravure press came in, and the great highlight was the old pre-comic book newspaper strips that were so wonderful in color and design and execution. My sister and I, when the paper would come, we would just spread it out on the floor and lie on it. It was so huge, and read all the various cartoons. Some were mediocre, some were quite good, But I guess that Charlie Brown and Peanuts killed that entirely when they realized you don't have to pay all these guys that do elaborate cartoons. You can have a little doodly squat cartoon that's 4 times smaller than any of these big things, and everybody loves it.
you're not a fan of Peanuts?
I certainly respect it, and everybody likes Charles Schulz himself, but the advent of the Doodly Squat cartoon, I do kind of regret. Why do we have to do it that way? It's because of the cancer of capitalism.
What about someone like Harriman?
Harriman existed in that era.
Yeah, do you like Harriman?
I love Harriman, and I'm reading about him now. I've got a cool book about Harriman.
You know Harriman Apple Crazy Cat?
Sounds familiar.
Crazy Cat is awesome.
Crazy Cat was written, you know, it's in a surreal landscape where there are unidentifiable objects in the background, and a crazy cat is this, you know, stylized 1920s cat character, and he is hated and loathed by Ignatz the mouse, who's always picking up a brick and throwing it and hitting him on the head. But Crazy, on the other hand, is loved by Officer Pup, who is like a dog that's also a cop, you know. The only thing between Crazy and Ignatz is malice. So there's this constant balance between these three characters in a strange, changing, wonderfully stylized landscape. And what am I leaving out, Floyd? When talking about Harriman. Because there's more to the strip than that. He also illustrated the book Archie and Mehitabel, which you might have heard about. By Don Marquis, yes. This cockroach would jump on the typewriter keys and wrote the novel, which is illustrated by Harriman.
That's great.
There's also...
You need to check that out. What year would that come out?
I'm afraid that's coming apart. That's a good one. I suppose that would be something to look up on your portable.
Early 20th century.
Oh, yes. Look, 30s, 20s, in that time, the pre-war time.
He was also, I guess, secretly black, so they say. Have you heard this?
Harriman was?
Yeah.
Well, I am sure I'll read about it in the book. I have the book. I'm getting ready to read it. I said I'm reading it, but I'm not reading it yet because I'm reading a book about Freddy the Pig and the Clockwork Twin. When my sister and I would go to the library as kids, we would read these incredible Freddy the Pig books. And I recently got this one. I was curious about the memories. We thought that the height of pleasure would be to go out trick-or-treating on Halloween, come back with huge bags of Halloween candy, then sit in the kitchen and turn the radio on so there was music, and both start reading Freddy the Pig books, like Freddy the Detective, Freddy and the Baseball Team from Mars. At one time, they try to go to Mars, but they end up back on the farm, but they think they're on Mars. The one I'm reading now is about a robot. It's called Freddy and the Clockwork Twin. And the robot is made to look like this kid who's been horribly abused by his parents, who escapes and runs away to the experimental farm where all the animals can talk. And they make this clockwork duplicate of him. And there's a sequence. It doesn't have a brain. It must be operated by one of these super intelligent animals from the farm. And inside the thorax, there's this little control room where a rooster, an English rooster, is operating the controls. And at one point, this robot kid is hitchhiking, and a truck driver picks him up, you know, and they start talking, and they're friendly, you know, getting closer and closer to home. And then they start doing imitations. I know I can do a really good cow, you know, listen to this, you know. And listen to this rooster, and he does a good rooster crow, but the clockwork kid says, oh, no, that's not, you could do better than that. And they argue back and forth. And then finally, just as he lets him off, the rooster opens a little trap door, sticks his head out, and goes, I know. The truck driver, you know, is totally dazed and becalmed, and cars are honking behind him, but he's staying still on the road, you know. The clockwork twin goes away. Then also the animals terrorize the abusive parents in an enjoyable sequence I just read. So I remember reading this from so many years ago. Librarians didn't like these books because they thought they were teaching children all this bad slang, which wasn't good English, slang of the 1930s. But I think it makes the book very charming.
Yeah, what's the title of this book again?
Well, the one I'm reading now is called Freddy and the Clockwork Twin.
Freddy and the Clockwork Twin, right. Okay.
Twin, the Clockwork Twin. He looks like the abused kid. Actually, his face was painted by an extremely talented, super intelligent cat named Jinx, who is a character in all the stories. But in this experimental farm, even the insects, some of them are intelligent and in league with the other farm animals. The author, Walter R. Brooks, wrote for The New Yorker, and he had a good writing career. The TV show Mr. Ed is based on a distorted thing, or is a distorted version of something that he originally wrote about a talking horse.
Oh, Mr. Ed, yeah, I've seen that show a couple times.
Yeah.
It's not very good.
No, it's not. But the inspiration, the thing that they based it on, supposedly was witty, though I haven't read it. I did see an episode just cycling through the channels where Mr. Ed got on the phone, manipulating it with his horsey mouth, and called Clint Eastwood, who was very hot in Hollywood at the time, and insulted him until Clint was going to come over and beat the hell out of the guy who called, and of course he pretended to be Wilbur, the other guy. So he had Clint Eastwood getting on his case because of Mr. Ed's malignant trickery.
Uh-oh.
Not just an excuse to have Clint Eastwood be on your show. I liked my favorite Martian, where Bill Bixby's next door neighbor was a Martian, and then moved in. They had a menage, apparently. The nosy neighbor next door was always suspicious, and so forth. But he was an amazing Martian, if you ever saw that one.
What did the neighbor do?
The neighbor, Mrs. Brown, I think she was always wondering about these two men that lived together and what they were doing, you know. But the Martian was Ray Walston, who was extremely urbane, and somewhat like one's caricature of a Martian. There you go. When he was about to perform any of his Martian abilities, like levitation was one, he could lift objects at a distance, invisibility was another, two antennas would grow out of the top of his head and stick up like a TV antenna with a comical sound effect produced by a slide whistle, I believe.
That's useful stuff right there.
But the thing about it, I suppose, that really appealed to me is that he is a total weirdo and an unknown in a world of people who know nothing about him. I remember in one episode he fell in love with a stripper and he actually blew his cover and told her about Mars and where he came from, and of course she wouldn't have anything to do with him. So he went back to his bachelor Martian life. And, well, you see, I was actually born in Grand Canal. Oh, I know where that is. No, this was Grand Canal, Mars. Ray Walston was the devil in Damn Yankees, that cool musical movie, if you've ever seen it. I'm not as good at making these as I thought I was. They don't seem to cohere. Let's try a different one.
Do you know about Elon Musk and Grimes' baby named Chi EX Axis 12?
That's terrible. Now I have to find this incriminating fragment I dropped on the floor. Could you tell me a little bit more about it?
That's all I know, actually. I was hoping you might know.
Man, that's enough.
Yeah, I don't really know anything about that. I mean, I know the Grimes have, like, a couple kids with Elon, but I don't know. I'm more into Grimes' music than like, her life as a mom with Elon's kids, naming her kid.
Well, you'd think
WFX4. You know, like,
somewhat.
She did that with, like, the first one. I was like, she's going to do this one with the rest.
It would be like a boy named Sue, where you give a kid a name that's going to cause trouble in life.
Oh, Apple, you should tell the story of meeting Frank Miller.
Oh, yeah, that was wonderful. So a few months back, I had a dream about Frank Miller, because this last year I was being more aware of my dreams. That was my goal, because I published an anthology called Dreams. So I had this dream about Frank Miller. I was like, okay, that was a crazy dream. And then I go to work at the Colbeck bookstore the next day, and three people ask for Frank Miller books. I'm like, okay.
Wow.
There's something to this dream here. Like, there's a Frank Miller theme going on.
Plato shrimp type convergence.
What is Plato's shrimp?
Well, in the movie Repo Man that Alex Cox made, it speculated that in the hovering atmosphere, there is the imminence of what's about to happen. And so you hear a phrase like, plate of shrimp, and then the next thing you see a plate of shrimp, and then you see people eating a plate of shrimp. And of course the movie plays with that by having an actual plate of shrimp keep appearing, you know, after they say
that film.
It's fun, and Alex was a great director, I thought.
Yeah, so that's basically what went on with Frank Miller. I go to the tattoo shop, and, like, I don't know, I tattoo a weird, like, bear head thing.
Oh, yeah.
On this, like, platypus. I think I want a bear. But my buddy Kurt Burdick comes in, and I tell him about this Frank Miller dream I had, and he was like, oh, Frank Miller's gonna be at Fan Expo this year. I was like, oh shit, I'm going to that.
When is that? Has it happened already?
Yeah, it happened already.
Oh, well.
It was in November.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, it happened every November, like, for the past few years, but I think that last year was the last Fan Expo for some reason. So that, I guess that was the last one, but I don't know, San Francisco always has a new kind of comic convention that's basically the same thing at the Moscone Center.
I always used to go to APE, the Alternative Press Expo, which is, you know...
Where was that at? Moscone?
I think Moscone, or down in downtown Oakland once...
Did you remember seeing young Mike Rieger tabling outside there selling mini comics?
I did not. I didn't know, of course.
Yeah.
That is great. So, I tell Kurt Burdick about this dream. He says, okay, Frank Miller's going to be at Fan Expo this year. I was like, okay, I'm going to meet him at Fan Expo. I go to my boss because he's the one that gets me tickets to Fan Expo, honestly.
Good for him. It's great.
Yeah, because, like, I just go there to help him table for his store, like, the Mission Comics store, and then I get, like, my little part on the table to sell my comics, but he's like, oh, we're not doing it this year, so I was like, oh, shit, I guess I'm not gonna meet Frank Miller. And then, the time comes by that the expo's happening, I didn't get any
deep
tickets.
Into the night,
and then 2 days into the expo, my friend Dope Cat was like, hey, I have an extra badge, you want to go to Fan Expo? And I was like, oh, yeah,
in
totally. So I go up there and
sings to her
I see Dope Cat. He gives me my badge.
I
and,
walk up there.
Yeah, Frank Miller is like right there with all the other inkers. There was a lot of really great inkers there. I met Mick Gray. He showed me his pen tips. He did Promethea. Did Promethea with Alan Moore.
Wow.
I met Arthur Adams.
Uh huh.
And Frank Miller was a couple of tables next to him, but the line was super long, so I skipped it. I was like, I'm not going to wait in line for this. I circle around, I come back, and the line is miraculously gone, and I just go straight to Frank Miller. I'm like,
great.
Hey, Frank Miller, there's a sign that in front of them that says it's $80 for, like, a signed print.
$80,
yeah. Yeah, I was like, Frank, I am so poor, I would give you any cash I have for you to just sign my art. And his agents were kind of eyeing me, like, they, like, I don't know, I was already talking to him, so they let me go. But he was like, it's alright, I'll just give you a print. And so he signed it for me, and I gave him Repulsive. He was super, super juiced about Repulsive.
Good. Well, that lasts longer than writing it on your arm.
Yeah, yeah. I've got, like, a Dark Knight print hung up at my house that's signed to Apple. And eventually his lecture comes around. I was like, I didn't even know Frank Miller had a lecture.
Cool.
I get into the Frank Miller lecture, and I was the first person on the microphone. And he's like, hey, what's up, Apple? I was like, hey, what's up, Frank? And I asked him some questions. And, the crowd applauded me for some I asked about a lecture. But,
did you get a good conversation going?
Bit. I just asked him about how a lecture evolved with Bill Sienkiewicz. Everybody knows it's my favorite comic book of all time. So I was asking him about the evolution of a lecture writing it with Bill Sienkiewicz, and he said, like, basically with Bill, once you give him an idea, he just expands on it like crazy, and the story basically turns into a whole other thing. And he just has characters in his mind that comes out really great in the art. That's what he's talking about. And yeah, I don't know. It was a very pleasing experience. I was drawing his portrait the whole time.
Nifty.
Yeah, and at the end of it, the interviewer guy was like, all right, everyone has to leave except for the golden ticket experience people. So I asked my friend Kurt.
Golden ticket, like Wonka's chocolate factory.
Yeah, like all the golden tickets got to stay for the picture, I guess. So I asked Kurt if I should, like, give him the portraits, and Kurt was like, yeah, go over there. So I went up on the stage and gave it to him. And the interviewer guy was like, this is how you get into the industry. And then he, like, had, like, the whole, like, crowd applause me, and then they, like, gave me, like, they gave me, like, a little interview, and then I shook, like, Frank's hand, and then I, like, tried to run away. And they're like, no, come back. You gotta give Frank your info. Frank wants your info. So I, like, went up back on the stage and gave Frank Miller my, like, contact information and, like, a couple more portraits to keep for himself. So, like, I don't know. I was like, I feel like we're besties now. That's my Frank Miller dream story.
Yeah. Keep in touch. People are mortal. They won't always be around. If you have an opportunity to meet them, you should meet them.
Yeah, man. I knew I was going to meet him, just like Crumb.
Crumb didn't like me, though.
That was the difference between...
He didn't?
Frank.
He wasn't rude to you, I hope.
Would, like, give me the Crumb treatment if I ever met him and I showed him my comics. I was like, man, like, Frank would probably treat me the same as Crumb. He'd be like, I don't like this. But Frank was talking about in this lecture that, like, you know, during the Comics Authority code era, the only thing that really entertained him was underground comics and Robert Crumb and stuff like that.
Well, I'm sorry, Crumb wasn't more responsive to your art, right?
No. Oh, yeah, Crumb was like, I don't like your art. You remind me of Sophie when she was a heroin addict.
Ah.
Oh, that I love you, Crumb. That's basically how the conversation
was. Well, that's, that was good of you. Yeah, I know what he means about Sophie, but she goes through various stages of drawing.
Yeah. Sophie's cool. I like her comic strips. I relate to them heavily, I do have to say.
I went to see Aileen once in a bar, but unfortunately there was this barfly who kept bothering us and getting in the way. Brian was to talk about getting more stuff in Weirdo. That never happened. I submitted 5 or 6 pages, maybe 5, maybe 6. There was one page we wondered whether we would include it to it, but the then editor Peter Bagg turned it down. You know, he didn't think it was Weirdo material. I would say, if it's in Weirdo, it's Weirdo material. And it was originally, it was later printed by, Clifford Neal. I had a momentary memory lapse there.
Peter Beg is just...
always all right. He's very,
man.
A good cartoonist, a good writer of cartoon gags. He just didn't like this particular thing that we did. Where in our story.